You're listening to this week's episode of Macquarie Street Matters, a podcast about the personalities and events in the New South Wales Parliament here in Sydney with Alistair Hinskins.
Well, welcome to this week's episode of Macquarie Street Matters. It's my great privilege to have the member for Castle Hill, Mark Hodges, new member of Parliament. Welcome, Mark, to Macquarie Street Matters.
Thank you, Alistair. It's very pleasing to be here for Macquarie Street Matters.
Now, look, I like to go through and talk to people a bit about their background, and you've got an interesting background and an interesting history with your electorate. I think you've lived in it for about 30 years. It is an electorate which has been represented by Michael Richardson, who, in fact, was a constituent of mine for a while after he moved to Killara. But you've also had Dominic Perrottet, you've had Ray Williams, you've had more recent members, and the seat has been completely redistributed, although it's kept its name. Is that?
Yeah, that's correct. The current seat of Castle Hill, I guess, is a mixture of the former seat of Baulkham Hills, which was represented previously by Wayne Merton and David Elliott. So it's a mixture of the former Baulkham Hills and a mixture of the former Castle Hill, which, as you correctly indicated, was Michael Richardson and Dominic Perrottet and more recently Ray Williams.
And it's been one of the most dynamic growing areas really in the Sydney Basin up in that northwest. It's teeming with families, sporting groups, community groups. It must be a great place to represent after you've lived there for 30 years.
Yeah, look, I love the Hills area. I love the Castle Hill electorate. And you are absolutely correct. It has changed. Its demographics have changed and its population has changed over the years. And it is a great place to represent. And apart from being a state member of Castle Hill, which I love, I'm also currently a councillor on the Hills Shire Council and former deputy mayor of the Hills Shire Council. So I've had the distinct pleasure and the honour of representing a very wide group of people.
When you first moved in there 30 years ago, there must have been quite a distinctive rural feel to the area.
Yes, there was. When I first moved into the Hills, which was, I guess, my parents moved into Carlingford, and it was might have been a bit more than 30 years ago. And when I got married to my wife, we also had a house at Carlingford and then at West Bennet Hills and remained at West Bennet Hills. So we've been there a long time. And it was a very rural area. And I guess, Alistair, the Castle Hill electorate is a mixture of more urbanised areas in the Baulkham Hills and the Castle Hill areas, and then as you go north of it in the great suburbs, Vanengrove and Kenthurst and Dural, Middle Dural, they are very rural still, and we hope to keep them rural and not to have too much greenfield development in those areas. And I know the council's attitude is that as well.
Now, your personal background is prior to you moving into the area 30 years ago, so you got a long history there. But your father was a policeman. Your mother, I think, was a nurse. You finished high school in Gosford. And you told a great story in your inaugural address. You had a job in Broadway and you used to get the train from Gosford to Broadway, which is a pretty long train journey even today, but was even longer back then when you were a younger man. And you met your wife on the train.
Yeah, that's right. I met my wife on the train. She was gorgeous, and we got to know each other, and I met her at one of the local clubs. In fact, her brother was in my class at school, or my year at school, and we got married, and we've been married ever since.
And two kids, and now I think a grandchild.
Right. Yeah, two children, Natalie and Matthew, and a grandson, Charles.
And you must look back on that time and just think, you know, who would have thought meeting a girl on a train would turn into that?
Yeah, I do. It's been a wonderful journey. Over 40 years of marriage now, and it's great. And, you know, we bought a couple of houses together and raised some wonderful children and still living in the Hills and still enjoying it.
Now, you trained at the, I think it was the Redfern Police Academy back then, I think before Goulburn maybe was established, or maybe there were the two. And then you worked in the police force, and you're actually the youngest senior sergeant to be appointed in New South Wales at the time. You must have been torn as to whether you would stay with the police or do something else.
Yeah, you're correct. When I was promoted to the rank of senior sergeant, I went from senior constable to senior sergeant. within the New South Wales Police Force, and I was the youngest senior sergeant in the history of the police force at that point in time. I was then offered a job to work in a firm of solicitors in the city, and it was a very, very difficult decision for me to make. I remember sitting in an office in College Street, which is now where the residence building is. It used to be the police headquarters, the John Avery building. And I had an office much like the view here overlooking the park and the harbour. And I sat there and thought about it for a very long time, and I took the view, well, I want to back my own ability as a lawyer. And I made the decision then to leave the police force, which was a hard decision. The police in New South Wales do a terrific job. I have huge respect for the members of the New South Wales Police Force. And it's like a club and a family, and they look after each other. And I made that observation earlier this week with three new probationary constables in my own electorate at Castle Hill. It's a very great honour to be a member of the police force, but also a great honour to serve the community as a lawyer, as you know. And it's a very great honour now that I have been bestowed upon me to be a member of Parliament, in this great Parliament.
You were obviously a person who was a high achiever, because you went from general duties as a police officer to then go into the prosecution section of the police force. And while you were in the prosecution section, you studied law and studied a law degree, all difficult things to do part-time, particularly studying law at Sydney University. The police prosecutors also do a fantastic job, don't they? It's a difficult job. There's just a constant flow of work coming through the local courts. And as the police prosecutors, you have to manage a huge caseload.
That's absolutely correct. The police prosecuting branch is the backbone of the legal system for the police department. When I was a member of the police prosecuting branch back then, the prosecutors used to do committal hearings, and they used to do a lot more work, a lot of traffic matters actually as well, which they don't do these days. And it was very time consuming, and to do it properly, you would spend a lot of time. The police prosecutors were given briefs on the morning of the court and expected to understand them, go up against senior barristers, sometimes QCs. I remember being in a matter at Hornsby Court, for instance, where I was up against a few Queen's Counsels, and I won the case. But it's, the police prosecutors, I have a lot of respect for them as well.
I must say, when I was a junior solicitor and did more work in the local court and more criminal work, I came to admire the police prosecutors very much. They seemed to be very hardworking, very diligent, very fair. And really, their role in terms of assisting the magistrates to process the criminal matters that came before the court is absolutely central to the administration of justice, as is in the district court. Crown prosecutors are incredibly important also, because, as you know, the role of a prosecutor is not to secure a conviction, it's actually to present all relevant information to the court so that people can be treated fairly through the criminal justice system. That's not to say that you're not trying to get a conviction, but that's not the aim of the exercise. You have an obligation to bring exculpatory evidence as well as evidence that tends towards conviction.
That's absolutely correct. And I thank you for your comments regarding the prosecuting branch, because one thing that's not in my inaugural speech was, as part of my time in the police prosecuting branch, I was asked to work in police headquarters in the police prosecuting training unit. So I spent a few years training some of the prosecutors along with some of the other people that worked there as well.
Now, I was greatly assisted as Shadow Attorney General last year on, I think it was almost the last day of Parliament or the last couple
last
of days,
week.
The last week of Parliament. The Attorney General had brought forward an amendment to Section 93Z of the Crimes Act, which raised an issue as to whether, if you did away with the current requirement that the Attorney General must give consent to a prosecution, as was currently in the legislation or was then in the legislation, whether by repealing that, whether taking that out would not only allow the police to initiate prosecutions, but also private individuals to initiate prosecutions. And I found you to be incredibly knowledgeable about criminal procedure, and also assisted me and the opposition to ultimately get an amendment to the bill, which Labor originally wouldn't agree to, but which we were able to convince members of the upper house was desirable, and then ultimately the Minns government agreed to that because we didn't want private criminal prosecutions in such a sensitive area. Section 93Z, I should say, being incitement to violence according to religious, racial and other grounds.
That was an exceptionally important amendment that we achieved in respect of that, and I was a bit shocked that the Attorney General at the time thought that it was appropriate that groups other than the police or the Attorney General could institute a prosecution. And it's highly important, instrument of appeal, I think it was. It was highly important that we made sure that it was only the Attorney General, because it was in the interests of justice, in the interests of making sure that appropriate matters were dealt with and not matters commenced by people
who had a different agenda than the public interest. And what I suppose was a bit disappointing and ultimately informed Parliament of this because of the way in which it had proceeded, but we had actually offered, we believed it was a drafting error, and we had offered privately, without any politics in it, because of the sensitive nature of the legislation, this is the sort of provisions that would be used when people have protests like they did on the Opera House steps and so on, where there were chants against Jewish people and so on, that this is the legislation that could come into play there. And we thought it was very important that there be a bipartisan approach, because it's legislation that is directed towards community harmony, not conflict. And Labor originally refused our hand of bipartisanship, which forced us to get the appropriate amendments in the upper house, which we were fortunate that the crossbench in the upper house was being a little less political than the Labor Party had been, and ultimately the Labor Party were forced to accept our change.
And that's because the government don't want us to be seen as letting the opposition or the crossbenchers have a win. They want to win at all costs, even if it's not in the interest of the community. Our amendments, your amendments that you brought forward in relation to 93Z,
yes,
were in the interest of the community.
Yeah.
And that's the way that our party always operates, as far as it will always operate, as far as I can see and as far as I have any involvement. We always act for the benefit of the community as a whole.
And I should give a shout out to Rod Roberts, who I think improved our amendments in the upper house. It was to a similar effect, but it was an improvement, and then that also helped. And he's a former police officer as well, so he had some insight into how we could better achieve that outcome. I must say, I mean, the other aspect was that we called for an inquiry in the upper house into 93Z, not just how prosecutions would be initiated, but also the substantive provisions to see whether they were fit for purpose. Labor voted that down. We couldn't get the numbers in the upper house. But then a matter of 4 or 5 weeks later, they announced an inquiry into Section 93Z and sent it off to the Law Reform Commission. So again, playing politics. And it's really disappointing that Chris Minns, on the one hand, presents himself as this avuncular, reasonable person, but we get to see that the way that Parliament and he operates Parliament is something else, and often unreasonable.
That's correct. Exactly how I see it as a new member, particularly in question time, particularly in some of the bills.
Now, can I just go to your practice as a lawyer? So you made that big decision that you decided that you would leave the police force and that you would go into private practice. And then I think you were in private practice for 29 years or so before you came into Parliament. What was the sort of legal work that you did as a lawyer?
When I went into private practice, one of the firms I worked with, which was a small firm, had as part of it a debt collection commercial litigation practice, whereby they received instructions from a commercial debt collection agency. I was offered all of that work. I went into private practice myself. So I made a decision in about 1984, I think it was, to go out and work for myself as a private practice. So I had a ready-made practice of debt collection insolvency work.
Mm-hmm.
So my practice was as a sole practitioner. Generally don't want to throw away work. So I did that, plus crime, being an ex-police prosecutor, so I kept my knowledge up in all criminal matters. Plus, I did some conveyancing. Whilst also being a sole practitioner solicitor, I also became involved in the Law Society. I think I spent 10 years as a member of the Litigation Law and Practice Committee. I also served on the Criminal Law Committee for Law Society, the Legal Aid Review Committee, and one or two other committees during my times involved in all of that types of work. And my practice was generally a mixture of commercial and crime.
Excellent. And it's very good if you are running a small business like a sole practitioner is, to have a degree of repetitive, regular work to keep the doors open and to give you cash flow. And I guess that debt collection work fulfilled that role for you. What are some of the highlights of your legal career as a practitioner?
Staying in business, I suppose, is the main one for that long. Oh, look, I was involved in some serious drug matters at some stage where I was representing people. One of the matters I recall specifically was very early in my career, and this wasn't a drug matter. It was representing some business people, and I won't name them, but they were Lebanese business people who were wrongfully charged. And this was very early in my career as a lawyer, I might add, but it stays with me. They were wrongfully charged with defrauding the GIO and instructed a couple of barristers, one being a Queen's Counsel, to represent the two people that I was representing. We went through a committal hearing. We went through a trial. At the end of the prosecution case, the judge gave a prasad direction and the case was dismissed.
So a prasad direction is where a judge doesn't believe that the Crown case could, at its highest, convict someone beyond reasonable doubt, and the judge steps in a way to protect the accused from an injustice happening, and then directs the jury to give a not guilty verdict as a matter of law.
That's correct. And I remember at the time that the judge gave that prasad direction, the emotion in the courtroom, particularly from my clients, was very, very high because it affected them. They were not guilty of the crime. I won't go into the overall facts of it, but there just wasn't any evidence.
I must say, I actually had a similar case as a young solicitor involving an alleged defrauding of, I think, the GIO and maybe other insurers with regard to the Newcastle earthquake and making false claims. And that case also, I actually think in that case, the Crown prosecutor exercised their discretion not to proceed in the middle of the trial when it became clear again that the case didn't have merit. I have observed throughout my career, and I haven't done nearly as much crime as you have, that the prosecutions don't seem to be as well done, I don't think, as perhaps more conventional criminal matters. It is a difficult and different area to ordinary criminal work, and it may be one of those areas. I don't know, maybe it's a lot better now. I'm probably relying on experience from more than a decade or more ago, but seems to me that that's an area that at least could have been improved back then. I don't know whether it has been.
Look, I think you're right. From my experience, both as a prosecutor over 10 years, when I was a police officer over 10 years, but also as a lawyer for 29 years, I do think the issues of prosecuting people for financial crimes, they're very difficult for the police. It's very difficult for investigators, and even it's difficult, I think, for the prosecutors. Over time, and I assume they still do it now, the police prosecuting branch have got brief handling managers and police prosecutors who specifically look into those financial crime matters. But it's still very difficult. And these days, Alistair, where financial crimes, frauds affect our community, particularly affect vulnerable members of our community, particularly affect businesses, companies that have relied upon money, more needs to be done by the government in resourcing the police to investigate financial fraud for our community, because it does affect people.
And essentially, it's a difficult area where you need good forensic accounting and a good understanding of how accounting and financial transactions operate. I did a lot of work for the banks recovering civil fraud where banks had been defrauded, and as a barrister, I often used to get injunctions freezing assets and things where there had been criminal activity, but from a civil perspective, in terms of trying to recover the money before it was dissipated. It is a complex area. It probably, I agree with you. I think it's going to be an area that more and more will require more resources and more attention, because it's becoming a bigger part of white collar crime within or crime within the community. Interestingly, there was recently on television that program about the British Postmaster General's office. I don't know whether you saw it, and I remember looking at that and thinking that the issues of forensic accounting and so on had a big role to play within the injustices that that program was about. After you've done public service in terms of the police force, you've got involved in the Law Society on voluntary committees, being involved in giving back and giving your expertise on various different Law Society committees. You then ran as a councillor of the Hills Shire Council.
Yes, yes. I was asked to nominate for the Hills Shire Council in the middle or early of 2021. Perhaps unlike some people who have sought positions in councils or public life as a member of parliament, I was asked by members of the party and the community to nominate in the Hills Shire Council. Now, there were competing groups, which is a matter of public record at the time. Ultimately, I was fortunate to be endorsed by the Liberal Party to run to be a councillor on the Hills Shire Council for what became the December 2021 election. And I was fortunate that the community chose to vote for myself and a number of my Liberal Party colleagues to be members of the Hills Shire Council. I was elected as a councillor on the 4 December 2021 elections.
Then you immediately became deputy mayor.
Yes, I did. I did. As the system works, the councillors, in fact, the Liberal Party councillors met, and they decided, perhaps because I've got a couple of law degrees, former lawyer, that they thought that I'd do a good job as a deputy mayor. And then on the 11th of January, at an extraordinary general meeting of the council, I was elected as the deputy mayor to serve for half of the term, which I remained as the deputy mayor until the 30th of April 2023.
And I think the first time we met was at an announcement with the current mayor, Peter Gangemi, where there was some state-funded infrastructure being delivered in the Hills Shire, and you were by then the Liberal candidate for Castle Hill. You obviously liked enough that community work as a councillor to then want to be a state parliamentarian. What are your hopes in terms of what you can contribute to state parliament, both at a local level but also perhaps broader?
Look, before I answer that question, I want to go back to when we first met. Right, if I may. You're right. We first met at George Thornton Reserve, which is when the government, the Liberal National Government, in fact you as the Minister for Sport, announced about $985,000 to contribute towards the upgrading of George Thornton Reserve at West Pennant Hills, and I live in West Pennant Hills. The reason I want to mention this is quite recently that money has seen the fulfilment of the third field at George Thornton Reserve. So I want to thank you personally for that. But I also do want to note right now on your podcast that when it was completed, now this is in accordance with the funding deed, the government sent along Peter Primrose, MLC, to have a photograph with the mayor to announce the completion of it as though it was their project, and it wasn't their project. And when I've seen the photographs with the mayor, Gangemi, and Peter Primrose spruiking about how great it was for them to fund it.
Did you get invited to that?
No, I wasn't invited.
That's interesting.
But having said that, the Redback Soccer Club that actually are using that field invited me and the mayor, and we cut the ribbon about 2 weeks ago. I was at George Thornton yesterday, I might add, with a whole lot of 2, 3, and 4 year old children from the kindergarten, and we walked around and we spoke about it. It's looking great.
And are they enjoying the facility?
They are. They do enjoy.
Well, that's the most important thing, I suppose. Not who cuts the ribbon. Having said that, the greatest activity of the Minns government so far has been cutting ribbons on projects that were thought of, funded, and construction commenced by the Liberal coalition government. And I must say that they must have repetitive stress injury in their hands cutting all those ribbons. But there's almost no, as you've explained on that one project, but that this has been throughout the state, repeated throughout the state. There's no recognition. There's often no invitation to the local Liberal member to go along with regard to projects that were Liberal initiated, Liberal funded, and the construction contract signed under a former government.
Yeah. But getting back to your question was, I obviously enjoyed my time as a deputy mayor and as a councillor to want to come to represent the community in the state parliament. I absolutely do enjoy representing the community. I enjoy helping the community. I was asked in October 22 by members of the party and members of the community if I would put my hand up to run for the state seat of Castle Hill. There were other candidates, and that's also a matter of public record what occurred with respect to the other candidates not being ultimately endorsed. So I was ultimately endorsed as a member for, as a candidate for Castle Hill, the March 2023 elections. And I have thoroughly enjoyed representing the community. It's a lot of work, and I will continue to work in the interest of my community and go to events and speak to my community and to attend Parliament to work with some very great members of the Liberal National Coalition like yourself.
One of the big issues that is creating a lot of anxiety in my electorate at the moment are the one-size-fits-all planning policies proposed by the Minns government, where apparently the most intellectual way in which the Minns government can provide more housing is to draw circles around railway stations and shopping centres and call that a housing policy. Is it generating significant anxiety in your area as well?
Yes, it has been. Has been generating a lot of issues in my area. It's not the area that they bought into, and they're very upset about it, and they've raised with me and very concerned about what this government is doing with their one-size-fits-all approach. It's a very lazy way to achieve more housing.
And it's a simplistic response to a very complex issue.
It is, and I might say this. What Chris Minns and Paul Scully don't understand is that it's not going to help what they're doing to achieve more housing. The Hills Council have, over the last 5 years, I think it is, approved over 30,000 housing sites, developments. Only 18,000 have actually been built. What is occurring in a lot of respects is developers are land banking. They get their development approvals and they sit on them. And there's a lot of areas that development and housing could be properly achieved sensibly. Councils, and this is not just the Hills Council, councils all over Sydney, that's been their job for many, many years, to determine where housing goes, to determine what's best for the community, and they do achieve it. Hills Council is one of the councils which is actually meeting and exceeding the set housing targets. And for the government to say, we're going to tell you to move out of the way, I think Rose Jackson, the Minister for Housing...
Get out of the way.
Get out of the way. That was in April 2023. She made a statement. A
couple of weeks after they were elected.
If you don't like it, get out of the way. What an extraordinary statement.
I know. It was incredible at the time. But it does definitely seem to be a policy of property developers before people. Can I just remind you that under the coalition, we created the Greater Cities Commission that worked with councils to identify where the housing could go. Targets were set, local housing targets were set. The planning laws that have been in place in New South Wales since 1979, Chris Minns seems to think the problem goes back to 1979. If the problem went back to 1979, the planning laws would have been changed back then. They cannot be the cause of the current problem, yet his solution is to override something that is not the cause of the current situation. And those laws, those 1979 planning laws which respect heritage, amenity, community and so on, trees and all the rest of it that we love in our areas, those laws were able, under the coalition working with councils, to deliver about 75,000 dwelling completions in New South Wales in 2018 before COVID came through and disrupted the housing market, immigration and all the rest of it. So there is a proven track record of being able to deliver housing supply and affordability by working with councils. Instead, Chris Minns thinks that the way to achieve a better outcome is to abolish the Greater Cities Commission, to abolish local housing targets, and to antagonise and take on councils all across Sydney. And that apparently is the way he thinks he's going to deliver more housing. If I can borrow from that great Australian movie, The Castle, he's dreaming.
That's exactly right. I mean, the problem with the way Chris Minns and Paul Scully are attempting to achieve housing is that our community, not being properly consulted, I mean, they put out their policies just before Christmas when everyone was away. Why did they do that? They didn't want it scrutinised.
They wanted to hide what they were doing.
That's exactly right. So they put it out. And what's going to happen now is our community, your community in Warraga, my community in Castle Hill, they're going to find that there's more development when the concrete trucks roll in, when the bulldozers demolish houses in their street, and they're going to have tradesmen all over the place. We see that now in the Castle Hill showground area, where there's more development, where the community are very concerned about the trucks rolling in.
Is this the Fred Caddiston?
No.
Or is that somewhere near?
This nearby, this showground area. Yes. It's the showground area is an area that Paul Scully, towards the end of last term, with a stroke of the pen, changed the local environment plan to increase the housing in that area. Back in about 2017, the Hills local environment plan limited the construction of housing within that precinct to 5,000 dwellings until there was appropriate infrastructure in place. Now, that would include a new school. Castle Hill High School has 51 demountable buildings. It is one of the largest populated schools in the states, probably number two, I think. And it's a very well-run school, but it's full.
Well, I think that's a good example of how the Greater Cities Commission, which we had set up to work with councils, was actually trying to coordinate infrastructure with housing as well, so you wouldn't get situations like you're describing.
I mean, the parents...
There's none of that in the Minns plan,
no.
I might add.
No. And I might say this, the Labor government, they want to talk about schools. They're building a whole lot of schools out near Riverston. Castle Hill, Kellyville, and other areas, your area, we don't get new schools, but we need them. We need upgraded schools. Castle Hill School is a very, very old school, and it's full. So let's hope that with the stroke of the pen that they can increase the housing within the showground precinct to 9,500 against the advice of, well, they didn't get any advice, they just did it, but I know the council don't agree with it, increasing the number of people. And that's in addition, I might add, to anything else coming as a result of the low to mid-rise housing policy reforms that they've announced recently.
Well, certainly in terms of informing the community, it's up to us, because Labor are trying to hide this as much as possible. It's up to local members like you and I to let our communities know about what's going on. Mark, we're running out of time, but can I just make this observation? My son's a crazy basketballer. He used to go and play at the Fred Caddiston basketball courts on many occasions. I used to have a rule with my son that when we'd play on a football oval named after someone, that we would investigate who they are. I think Fred Caddiston was a war hero, a state member of parliament. There's a big tradition in the Hills of having great community-minded people represent the area. It's been great to see your life of community service now being extended into state parliament. I wish you all the very best, and thank you for joining me on Macquarie Street Matters.
Thank you, Alistair. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks, Mark. I know you.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Macquarie Street Matters, and I look forward to you joining us again next week.